It's a tense moment for Ukraine. The optimism that followed Ukraine's early successes on the battlefield in 2022 started to fade last summer as its counteroffensive failed to achieve a breakthrough. By late 2023, Ukraine's then commander-in-chief said the war had reached a stalemate. And by the start of the spring, things were looking even worse, with high-ranking Ukrainian officers warning a collapse of the front lines could be imminent without more weapons from Washington. In mid-April, after months of partisan gridlock, the U.S. Congress finally passed a $60 billion aid package, buying Ukraine some time and some hope. But Ukraine's defense still faces major headwinds, and Russian forces have continued gradually advancing along various sections of the front line in recent weeks. Amid this enormous uncertainty, a new report from the International Crisis Group aims to distill the lessons of the past year for Ukraine and its backers. According to Simon Schlegel, the group's senior Ukraine analyst and my guest today, if Ukraine and its partners take these lessons into account, Russia's aggression is likely to fail. But applying them will be anything but easy. Welcome to The Naked Pravda. Hi, I'm Medusa in English senior news editor Sam Brazil, and you're listening to The Naked Pravda. This week, I spoke to Simon Schlegel, senior Ukraine analyst at the International Crisis Group, about the group's new report, Ukraine, How to Hold the Line. Before we got into the report's recommendations, I asked him to lay out the long-term stakes for Ukraine and the wider region if it fails to bring Russia's advances to a halt.
The stakes for Ukraine are existential. Just its survival as an independent nation, as a sovereign state, are on the line. If Ukraine doesn't hold the line, Russia will pressure it into a non-favorable ceasefire or peace deal, and that would ensure that Ukraine cannot build up its army again, it cannot build up its defense industry again. It would be basically in the waiting room until the time Russia decides it's back to full strength and can try another attempt at it, fully subjugating Ukraine and really fulfill its original war aim, which is to have a direct say in who governs in Kyiv and what their domestic policies are, but also what their geopolitical alignments is. And so that would be a very insecure future for Ukraine that would undermine its capacity of rebuilding, would undermine the economic recovery because nobody would want to invest in such an insecure future. And it would also undermine the demographic recovery of Ukraine. The people who have left already would be unlikely to come back, and other young and entertaining people would probably leave because they don't see their own future in Ukraine. So that it would further undermine Ukraine's future potential of building a strong state and a strong economy. For wider Europe, it would probably also mean a very insecure time to come. It would test the unity of Europe and the unity of NATO. It would incentivize nations to care for their own security first before they care for the security of wider alliances like NATO. And it would certainly also endanger the European integration path of Moldova and Georgia, which would look at Ukraine and see that this is a very risky path, and they would tread much more carefully in how much they push this idea of becoming members of the European Union.
If Ukraine does hold the line and a deal is struck where the current front lines are basically recognized, are you and your co-authors saying this would not lead to this new, more aggressive Russia? Or is it just sort of the best we can reasonably hope for right now?
If Ukraine can hold the line and also telegraph to Moscow that any further advance would be too costly and that it can hold the line in a way that it can actually build up a better defensive capacities, more security, that it can rebuild its economy and continue European integration, then it would indeed signal to Russia that further aggression doesn't pay off as much as they planned, that maybe invading Ukraine in 2022 was actually a strategic mistake. So yes, holding the line and then also rebuilding the security infrastructure, the defense industry behind that line, that would indeed probably deter Russia from trying to attack in other places. Yes.
In this scenario where Ukraine fails to hold the line and where we get what you and your co-authors call a new Russia, a more bellicose Russia with a wartime economy, even after this war, What predictions can we make about how sustainable this would be for Russia and how long this new Russia might be able to last?
It's really hard to put dates to that because, of course, Russia's history is full of black swan scenarios, and nobody predicted the disintegration of the European Union or the Prigozhin mutiny a year ago. But so far, Russia has been incredibly resilient to the economic pressure, to the sanctions that came out of the invasion. It's very difficult for the West to actually enforce these sanctions and to make them more watertight. Russia has used the invasion as a pretext to suppress whatever civil society and free press there was left. So any political opposition to this bellicose future of Russia is very unlikely. Energy revenues may continue to shrink, of course, but they will still be substantial, and weapons production capacity could also plateau as labor shortages and inflation bites. But for now, Russia is also, it's not just producing for the front, it's filling its warehouses and refilling its warehouses. So it's actually investing in the sustainability of just its bellicose future. And then we don't know what role China is going to play. China is probably already in some way or other helping Russia sustain its industry that produces weapons, and it might find out that this isn't something that is hurting them too much. Then they might do this more actively and more openly in the future, and that might sustain the Russian defense industry for a long time to come.
Each time the U.S. or one of Ukraine's European allies sends Kyiv weapons that it previously ruled out or authorizes something it previously hadn't, like limited strikes on Russian territory, and this doesn't lead to disastrous escalation or nuclear war, a lot of observers say this is evidence that these things really should have been authorized earlier or at the very beginning, and blame the allies for not doing more earlier. But this report seems to make the case, or at least asks us to consider the case, that this incrementalism looks in retrospect to have been a really wise option and maybe even the best option. Can you talk a little bit about that?
First of all, it's important to acknowledge, of course, the Ukrainian standpoint that any delay is very costly for them in terms of lives and in terms of territory as well. But it's important to be realistic about what could have been sent in the beginning, and also to think with the mind of a Western politician who also carries a lot of responsibility of what might be the consequences of Russia overreacting and actually escalating this war. So the incrementalism, as much as it was costly for Ukraine, it gave Western partners the ability and the time to assess the risks and to mitigate them, and then assess the reactions of Russia and then decide the next step. And with that incrementalism, it was probably also possible to send types of weapons that in the beginning nobody even thought of sending to Ukraine, such as longer range weapons that can hit the port of Sevastopol. That is something that probably any military planner in a Western capital would have rejected out of hand in the March of 2022. But then as the war went on and as these red lines were moved carefully, it became also possible to think in terms of what sophisticated and heavy weapons can be sent to Ukraine. It's also important to realize that sending really sophisticated weapon systems in the early weeks of the war into a very chaotic situation would also have made these weapons easy targets for Russia. If you send a Patriot air defense system, for example, it was really important to prepare the ground for those and to make sure that upon their arrival, they have a bit of a survival time and can actually have a big impact. If they would have been sent in March 2022, they would have been a sitting duck and would have been taken out by Russian missiles very quickly. The same is true for fighter jets that needs quite a bit of not only training, of course, but also preparing the air bases for them to be secure enough to host them. And that has created delays, of course, and the delays had the opposite effect as well, that in some cases, the window of opportunity when a new weapon system would have had a big impact also closed before they arrived. For example, the main battle tanks like Leopards, when they arrived in the spring and summer of 2023, the Russians had already fortified their lines so heavily that these tanks couldn't have the impact that was expected for them.
I want to talk a bit about the weapons situation and not about the U.S. so much because we don't know what the outcome of the presidential election is going to be, but the situation in Europe, which seems more stable. So do Ukraine's European allies appear to have learned some lessons from the first 2 years of war? And are they on track to feasibly give Ukraine a fighting chance, even if the U.S. rapidly pulls back after November?
Well, any rapid pullout of the United States would be definitely felt on the Ukrainian battlefield. So Europe is on a good track to significantly expand its weapons industry, but it's not yet close to being able to replace the United States in full, and not in pace and not in volume. The United States is still able to send double the amount of weapons that the Europeans are currently able to produce. They have learned a lesson that long-term planning is really important. If you calculate with a long war in Europe, that is really important that defense contractors get long-running contracts that allow them to make the type of investments that are needed in Europe. Building new factories and hiring new people at the foundation for this has been laid, but these are all very long processes, and we're no longer in the situation where we can just draw down on warehouses. So any European replacement of America's volume is dependent on how quickly these factories can go up and start to turn out ammunition and air defense interceptors. Also, not the full range of what Ukraine has received from the US can just be replaced by Europe. Europe so far doesn't produce Patriot systems, for example. So it's really also important that these gaps get closed in time. And so I think the realization has definitely sunk in politically. There's not, in that sense, a fatigue that Europe is just giving up. But building factories is a very different process from just opening the doors of warehouses, which has been what the West has been doing so far, mainly. And there's so many other factors like European regulations, labor regulations, security regulations that are very different from the way Russia works. Russia had, through its nature as an authoritarian state, just a comparative advantage in ramping up its defense production very quickly. Europe might do that more sustainably in the long run, but it might be behind the curve. And any pullout of America would be felt very painfully on the Ukrainian battlefields.
Can you talk a bit about the specific challenges posed by these more advanced weapon systems that require a lot of training or that need troops from the donor states to actually operate them? I think the main one is the German Taurus missile, which obviously it has a different meaning for Russia when there are German troops in Ukraine operating these weapons.
Yes, I think it's specifically the Taurus where the assessment by the German government that it would require German troops to be present from on the air bases where these weapons take off from, that this would create a danger that their own soldiers become a target for Russia. So this red line is probably also crumbling with statements made by the French, by Macron, that sending instructors or sending troops to Ukraine cannot be ruled out at the moment, at least. That is mainly there to create ambiguity. And of course, the picture of a German or French coffin draped in a German or French flag arriving back from Ukraine could sour the political mood in any of these countries. But I think we're also, with the realization that this is a really long war, there are also alternatives to that in terms of training Ukrainians for using these weapons if necessary, for a very long time. It's just that the experience of 2023 really also shows that most of these red lines start to erode at some point, and that it might make sense to prepare for that situation, especially when then from that point on, the training and the preparation of the ground takes a long time. It might make sense to outsource that specific type of training outside of Ukraine if the assessment really is that foreign troops in Ukraine pose a really big risk.
Ukraine has no major problems with the number of foreign trainers coming to train Ukrainian personnel, but there are a lot of problems with the training itself that they're getting. It's often kind of irrelevant to the reality on the ground that soldiers experience. So how did we get here and how might it be fixed?
Well, I think we got here because NATO army trainers or NATO army instructors would mainly instruct Ukrainian soldiers in the way they know how to do, but the fight that the NATO army would pick up looks really different from the one that Ukraine was forced into. And it's also not just, it's not static, right? It's a constantly evolving battlefield with huge progress in drone technology and electronic warfare. So it's really also important that these training programs remain really adaptable. And it's probably not possible for foreign instructors to keep up to date with all these developments. So what is likely going to happen is a division of labor between foreign trainers and domestic trainers. Domestic trainers need to better reflect this evolving battlefield reality in their training. The Ukrainian army is trying to establish better after-action review, better feedback loops, and better lessons learned to bring this into training programs. It's not easy to do that because you have to send people to frontline command posts where everybody is really busy and ask them to share their fresh lessons learned with them. And then you have to feed that back into training programs on training bases in Ukraine. That leads to a situation where you have a big rear and these troops there are often not sufficiently trained for the battlefield. And then it's not really possible for frontline commanders to replace their experienced and battle-hardened troops with troops from the rear. And that, of course, is sort of a vicious circle where then the troops at the front lines get reduced and more exhausted, whereas the troops waiting in the back do not develop the skills and cannot profit from their experience to develop these skills. So this feedback loop needs to become more active and the battlefield experience needs to feedback better into training programs in Ukraine, whereas foreign training probably will have to be focused on leadership skills and tactical medicine and on officers, on non-commissioned officers who have the burden of administrating and commanding in the field for their leadership skills and, of course, for Western weapon systems, whereas the actual battlefield experience probably needs to come from Ukrainians who have actually lived through that experience.
This report has a long section about the importance of planning for negative contingencies, because, of course, things are going to go wrong, especially right now with basically everybody predicting an especially tough few months ahead. So how successful has Ukraine been so far at planning for contingencies and dealing with bad outcomes, things like evacuating civilians from territory that falls under Russian control? Has it had the capacity to plan for these things?
Indeed, I think these capacities are really limited. I think Ukrainian military planning has often been in this firefighting mode, as we have seen in this most recent attack in Kharkiv, where the reaction to that was redeploying troops from other sections of the front line to contain it there and then weaken other sections, of course, by doing that. So the planning for contingency is really hard when the front lines move so fast. But now, as holding the line is the maxim at the moment, that becomes more important. And I think what Ukraine has been trying to do, but has been late is building more defensive lines, fortifying those defensive lines a couple of kilometers behind the actual fighting line that they then can fall back on if pressure gets too high. The problem with that has long been that the artillery and also the presence of glide bombs in the zone right behind the front line and behind the international border between Russia and Ukraine is very dangerous to work in. And that delays, of course, the whole process. It's really dangerous to bring in machinery and bring in trucks with concrete blocks into these areas. And therefore, these defensive lines have been built deeper inside Ukraine-held territories, for example, around the city of Kharkiv and not so much close to the international border. And it's probably also been too late for some sectors, so they're quite likely to be weak spots in this defensive line that Russia probably knows about and that it will try to exploit. But another strategy that the Ukrainians have been using is, of course, to try to soften Russia's supply lines by attacking them in the rear. They've been more successful than fighting in the front lines. They've been in attacking Russia's rear and making it impossible for the Russians to amass big units and big assemblies of military gear. That has certainly helped to avoid big breakthroughs so far. They might continue to do this, especially now with the loosening of restrictions on using Western weapons on Russian soil. That strategy might become more viable also along the international border where Russia is probably trying to, again, divert troops away from the most contested areas of the front line.
You and your co-authors write that Russia seems bent on continuing the war and gaining from it, while Ukraine's inability to show significant results, this is my words now, over the last year has caused it to lose a lot of the goodwill it enjoyed in the first stage of the full-scale war. Basically, people are more hesitant to support it when victory seems less likely. At the same time, Ukraine's leaders continue to focus on accountability and justice on an international level as the only acceptable outcome of the war and restoration of Ukraine's borders, rather than focusing on the prospect of deals that might stop the fighting but would be very painful and unsatisfying for Ukraine and its supporters. So what possibilities does this leave for the fighting to come to an end in the absence of total victory for one side or the other?
The most likely possibility is that both sides get to a stage where they think that fighting further is too costly, and that only then they really go to the negotiation table. But they would probably still go to the negotiation table with maximalist demands and then start to retreat from those bit by bit in what are said to be certainly long and painful negotiations. At present, of course, Russia is also asking for a maximalist outcome through its rhetoric of new realities, which almost certainly means for Ukraine giving up territory. That is just domestically for the Ukrainian government, that would not be survivable politically. And so that it's probably not unwise for them to not signal agreement with territorial losses. And there is, of course, always the hope, and I think we've also tried to lay this out in the report, that Ukraine might get to a position where it can at least secure its future ability to rebuild and become a more secure country, and also its future ability to freely choose its political alignment with other countries. So there is, of course, still room for that for Ukraine to achieve a better outcome than if it would enter negotiations now. Now that would be just not really meaningful diplomacy. It would be a capitulation in installments if Ukraine would go to the negotiation table now. It would just have to basically accept Russia's demands. And I think the realization within Ukraine, but also within its supporters, at least in Europe, is still that that's not worth at the moment, that the cost of that would be higher than the cost of keeping on the fight. And therefore, the best thing to do in the future at the moment is to try to reduce the cost of this fight, but keep it and try to get to a better negotiation position.
Russia regularly signals, I think it did this last week, that Putin is ready to come to the negotiating table, but they maintain that any peace deal would require Ukraine to accept the new realities, which is how they refer to Russia's claims to Ukrainian territory. Why do this like every 3 months? What does Putin get by signaling this?
Well, it allows Putin to show himself as the peaceful party in this, that Moscow is the force of stability and the reasonable side that wants to negotiate and end the bloodshed. And it's enough to do that, as you say, every 3 months to always keep this sort of in the loop and just flood the space with these propositions, however improbable they are. That is good, probably first of all, for the domestic market, that people in Russia hear that their government is actually willing to make peace and so that they're not the culprit at home. It's certainly good for the political forces that are sympathetic to the Kremlin in the West, but not just for those. I mean, if you just look at the press coverage of the rumored near peace deal in Istanbul in March 2022, and then just the arrival of Boris Johnson in Kyiv spoiled all of that. If you just look at how widely that was discussed in reputable media in the West, it's really a good strategy to signal readiness to negotiate, because most of the audience doesn't have the time to look in all the details and how far apart the details were still in this alleged close peace deal. And it's also probably important outside of the West to cultivate good relations with countries that don't want to take sides. And it allows Moscow there to paint itself as a force of stability as well. That is exactly what the Ukrainians try to undermine with their peace initiatives that try to bring together a lot of countries from outside the West, and Moscow as an alternative can portray itself as the force of peace. It doesn't matter how absurd that is. I think it's just important to sort of plant that narrative out there and then let it do its job from there.
If these signals about negotiations are meant to make Putin look plausibly kind of like a good guy, what about his semi-regular statements about nuclear weapons? We saw it again just today at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. He invoked Russia's nuclear doctrine again. What does this do for him?
I mean, they're not contradictory, right, to signal that he wants to make peace, but if not, he could initiate an escalation that would be potentially world-ending. I mean, that raises the cost of not wanting to make peace for everybody. It has definitely had the effect on Western nations that they have been very cautious with every red line that they've crossed slowly. So it has certainly put the brakes on Western military aid, because just the stakes are so high. If the threat is a nuclear attack that any responsible politician has to take it seriously and show to its own electorate that he or she takes it seriously. So it has definitely done its job, but it's probably also important to see that the threat is much more important than the actual possibility of use, because it would clearly have very unpredictable consequences. But it still has the effect that Western nations do not say that they want Russia's defeat, right? The signaling is that we don't want Ukraine to lose, but having Russia with its back against the wall is still a scenario that is freaking out most Western leaders. And that is because of this regular signaling that nuclear weapons are in the cards.
So at the moment, Russia seems to be feeling pretty good. This report lays out a number of areas in which it's been really fortunate, or maybe really shrewd, since the start of the full-scale invasion, but things that have gone right for it. One of them is high energy prices and prudent financial management. There's also the willingness of many other states to skirt sanctions and trade with Russia. Then there's the successful redirection of its domestic industry to serve its wartime economy. And finally, its wide-ranging effort to acquire weaponry from places like Iran and North Korea. Do any of these factors seem to be under threat or likely to run out, let's say, in the next year?
Well, I think under threat, yes, but not quickly. I mean, the high energy prices, the effect of that has waned somehow. If we look at Gazprom's statement that they didn't make a profit for the first time since the 1990s, I think the loss of the European gas market, at least, does have an impact here. And replacing that income with sales to China and other countries is not as easy as it is with oil, of course, where you can use shadow fleets of tankers. So I think that's a chunk of income that is really hard to recover, but it might be able, you know, Russia might be able to recover that by building new pipelines at some point. Other than that, I think it's really likely that Russia is going to try to stabilize its economy and to try to cultivate good relations with other authoritarian states around the world. And many states will remain willing to do so, I think. I don't see that Iran, if it can make money out of supplying Russia with weapons, that it would stop to do that. It's very likely that if China feels that it can get away with supporting Russia more actively, and if that is a good source of income, that they will do that. So I don't see any of these factors reliably waiting. But then, of course, there are black swan scenarios. A political collapse in Russia is always possible, but it's certainly not something that we should build a strategy on for the West or for Ukraine. So it's more likely that most of these factors are going to be around for a long time and that Russia can bank on them. I think it's important to say that it's not a lost cause. There is an avenue to make Ukraine stronger, to make Ukraine able to hold the line and to get to a much better position than we're in now. And for that, it's really important to learn the lessons and to become more strategic in supplying Ukraine and for Ukraine in supplying its army with well-trained soldiers. But it's really important, I think, to not give up after a failed counteroffensive last summer. And I think it's also important that, you know, that there is no sense of exhaustion and fatigue in Ukraine's backers. Of course, the perspective of a quick win has gone away, but I think it's really important to keep the optimism up, as, by the way, Ukrainians are really good at, and definitely that's the sort of the defining emotion around Kyiv.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been The Naked Pravda, a podcast from Medusa in English. Remember that undesirable status back in Russia means our entire news outlet now relies on readers and listeners around the world to support our work. Please visit our website for information about how to become a contributor with one-time or recurring pledges. Thanks again. Until next week.